You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ben Lurie's first book is a collection of short stories, very short stories. One of them is just three sentences long. They're lean, compact, and mysterious. And from the duck who's in love with a stone to the television who decides to write an opera about Churchill, Mr. Lurie's main characters are evocative, unpredictable, and odd. These pieces can seem like fables or prose poems, and their meanings are sometimes elusive. The book is called, kind of elusively, Stories for Nighttime and Some for the Day, and it's published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ben Lurie to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You originally planned to publish a collection of 101 stories. What, I'm assuming, that's because you were thinking about the Arabian Nights.
Yep. Well, I think it's important to have a goal. So when I started writing, I was writing very short stories, and I didn't know exactly what it was going to become, but it seemed like 101 was a nice goal, and it would feel important and large. And one of my favorite books that I read for inspiration is a Ray Bradbury collection of 100 stories, and there's just something about the number 100 which makes it seem like a book worth buying.
Well, you would have done one more, but did you ever reach the 100 mark?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I wrote many, many more than 100. I wrote a couple hundred, and the process of writing the book was a process of constantly writing and substituting, taking out ones that didn't match up, and I only really knew I was done when I could no longer take stories out, when I was just in love with all the stories in the book.
Although one of the stories you were forced to include, one of the best stories.
I wasn't forced to include it. They offered me a book deal, and I was happy to have a story in there. I just didn't want it. I wanted it separated from the rest of the book because it's a different kind of thing.
It had been published in The New Yorker.
Yep.
And it's a lot longer than these other stories.
Well, by my standards, yeah, most of my stories are around 4 pages long, and that one was probably maybe 7 times as long as that.
So you wound up cutting the book down to 40 stories. And according to your title, there are some here for the day and others for the night. What's the difference between a story for the day? And I've always wondered in listening to Indian music, why is this an evening rag? Why is this a night rag?
That's an excellent question, and I have no answer for you.
just to play games with the title?
Well, I always liked Stories for Nighttime. That seemed like a really good title, but then it seemed like there were some stories that maybe really didn't fit into that, and so then I added in some for the day, and that sounded even better. And then I never really thought about which ones were going to be which, and a lot of them, I think it just depends on how you look at it.
Well, Scheherazade was telling stories to save her life one night at a time.
Right.
You were under no threat, were you?
Not that I know of, though sometimes it feels that way.
So when you were making the final cut, was it totally your decision, or did the editors participate?
No, it was my decision. I was worried about that, actually, when they offered me the deal. But then they said no, that I could pick, and it turned out that they meant it. There was one story that, I edited it down to 50. That was the best I could do, and then I handed it in, and my editor sort of picked some from there, and we did a little wheeling and dealing. And then there was one story that he really wanted in, which I had not included, called The Well, which I actually had not included because I thought he had said that he didn't want it in. So it all worked out. Yeah, no, they were very nice about it.
And you divided the book into 3 sections. Is there a theme to each of the sections?
No, not really. I like reading short story collections that are divided up just because it gives you a sort of a resting place. The stories are in chronological order, and there is like an arc to the book, but that arc doesn't really correspond to the section breaks.
So that's what you decided to do, to put them in the order that you'd written them?
Yeah, yes.
Most writers think that the latest story is the best story, so they always want to lead with that.
Oh, no. Well, they're all the best story. No, they changed a lot over time. When I first started writing them, they were very dark, and they were generally about a single character in some sort of terrifying circumstance. And then as I wrote them, I was writing them over a period of years. It's almost 6 years since I started writing this book. And as the stories went on, more and more characters began to enter the picture, Sometimes one of them would be a woman, and there would actually be some hope suddenly in the world. And then at some point, animals started talking in some of the stories, and then inanimate objects started talking. One story is about a tree. There's one about a television, one about a house. And then after that, things sort of just exploded. So it really did have a movement to it that I didn't want to ruin by putting the stories out of order.
So one story, what you did in one story opened up a door for the next story.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that you started writing in a horror writing workshop. That's why they were dark at the beginning?
Well, I did start writing in a horror writing workshop, but that's not really why they were dark, I don't think. I think they were dark just because that was what was coming out of me. The class was, it was really the first time I'd ever written a short story. Before that, I had been a screenwriter, though never a very good one, and I had always been trying to write stories by assembling scenes. I mean, I would come up with ideas for different scenes, and then I'd try to group them together into a single story. But the thing that happened in that story writing workshop was that my teacher told me to stop trying to plot things out, just start at the beginning and follow the character in the story and see where it goes without planning. So the stories tend to come from my unconscious or subconscious or whatever, and they just tend to be whatever I'm thinking about.
Well, some writers very comfortably plot things out. Others mm-hmm. follow your teacher's advice and go wherever the story takes them.
Yeah.
You feel you do it better when you follow the second approach?
Well, I feel that I don't do it at all when I try to do it the other way. I'm just completely paralyzed.
You don't know the ending ever?
No, I never know the ending. The ending is always the hardest part.
Well, I was thinking about horror, but I see the Twilight Zone influence more readily.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So, but even though Twilight Zone is not really horror.
Well, it counts as horror, I think.
What would you call these stories? Allegories? Fables?
I just call them stories. Sometimes when I send them out, when I started sending them out to journals and magazines before the book got picked up, I started calling them fables just to sort of let editors know that the language was going to be different than the usual story, that it wasn't just going to be another normal type story. But I don't think they're really fables, although there are talking animals in some of them.
Now, when you say the language is different, that's because you've pared it down?
Yeah, there are no metaphors or similes, no fancy language.
Stephen King says that he takes out all the adverbs.
Really?
Yeah. Or as many of them as he can.
Yeah.
And I remember William Styron once saying that he had to cut 200 pages from a book, and the interviewer asked him, were there any really interesting scenes that you had to give up? He said, no, just adjectives and adverbs.
I've actually heard that that's how James Ellroy developed his style in White Jazz, that they didn't want to publish his book, which was, I think, like 600 or 700 pages long. So he just cut it down by making all the sentences into fragments. And that was really how his new style developed.
That's how he talks as well.
Really?
Aesop always finishes his fables with a statement of the object to be learned. But you don't do that. You let your readers draw their own conclusions.
Yeah, I don't think I'm really in any position to teach anybody anything.
But do you trust them to get it right?
Well, I don't know that there's anything to get right. I kind of feel like the purpose of stories, or at least my stories, or these stories, sort of to strip things away from people and not to teach them or tell them how to do anything, but to sort of bring them back to where they are and what's going on around and inside them.
My guest is Ben Lurie, L-O-O-R-Y. His book, Stories for Nighttime and Some for the Day, is published by Penguin. You mentioned that some of your characters are animals or inanimate objects, and most of your main characters, human or otherwise, have no names.
Right.
Some writers have so much fun giving their characters names. You deny yourself that pleasure?
It was never a pleasure to me. Names always irritate me.
But you give names to secondary characters.
I only give names to characters when it would be awkward not to. I mean, if there are a couple characters in a scene and there's dialogue, then you kind of need a name so you know who people are talking to. Or if there are, you know, two people. Well, yeah, anyway, I already said
that. For example, the octopus in the story of the same name has no name, but his two nephews, also octopi, are named Gerald and Lewis.
Yeah. Actually, the octopus does have a name, but you only see it in the letter that his nephews write him from the sea. They say, "Dear Uncle Harley."
Mm. Is this Harley, who lives in an apartment on land, known only as the octopus because he's the subject of the prejudices of his neighbors, all humans who can only see his animal self?
I have no idea.
You didn't think about that?
Nope.
So did these stories come to you in images?
Yeah, the way...
I mean, putting an octopus in an apartment?
Yeah. The stories all... The way that I write stories is by having no ideas at all. What I do is I make my mind as blank as I can, and I sit down at a computer and I wait for the first image, or sometimes it's a line of dialogue, but usually it's an image. And I just start with that image, and there's a character who interacts with whatever that is, be it a duck or a rock or an octopus, a teacup.
Now, you didn't do this when you were writing screenplays, did you?
No.
So is this totally – have you ever thought of writing a screenplay again, knowing what you know?
Yeah. At the moment, a friend of mine and I are adapting one of the stories from this book called UFO, A Love Story, into a screenplay.
Do you feel the need to logically justify the predicaments or circumstances of your characters? For instance, do you know why the octopus left the ocean in the first place?
I do, yes.
Yeah, not telling. You're not sharing that with us?
Well, he left the ocean because he wanted to live forever. He heard that if you went to land, you would live forever.
Okay.
I mean, the premises of the story, I don't feel the need to justify, but there's definitely logic to the way that the stories play out. Almost a mathematical logic, really, and most of the process of writing. Most of these stories I write very fast, in like half an hour or so, and then spend maybe 2 or 3 or 4, sometimes 5 years, trying to figure out the right ending for the story. So there's definitely logic to them.
Well, one of the things that you don't have to deal with that so many writers do is answer the autobiographical question.
It's all right there on the page. I don't know how I could write a more autobiographical book, to be honest.
One of the horror stories is about a shark in a swimming pool, although we're not sure that the shark is really there. What happens when the pool gets drained?
Well, the man who sets out to get the pool drained because he sees the shark in there and is worried for all the children. He's very happy when the pool is drained, and he goes to watch it be drained. But when all the water's gone, he realizes that he set the monster loose, and now it's out in the world.
I felt that many of the settings in your book, including that pool with the shark and the tunnel the little boy goes into, were representatives of places or processes in our psyches, almost something sure. that a Freudian or a Jungian might connect to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're all basically just dream images. I tend to think basically what I do is dream on paper and then sort of force myself to resolve the conflicts in the dreams.
Now, the stories aren't religious, but there's a real sense of another spiritual dimension in the world that you write about. Is that intentional?
It's not intentional, but it comes with me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're working on a screenplay. Mm-hmm. Of one of these stories. And are you still writing more short stories, really short stories?
Oh, yeah. The day I finished this book, I woke up the next day and I started writing another book. It's also short stories like this, but they're linked. They're written in first person, and they all take place in the same town. It's kind of like a Winesburg, Ohio kind of thing.
But most short story writers, their goal is to be published in The New Yorker or Harper's or one of the few other magazines that publish short stories these days, and then have them put together in a collection. Your stories are too short for that.
So
you're just writing them with the idea of a collection in mind?
Yep. I think of them as a book. To me, it's a book. It's not a collection. I've never really liked the word collection. It makes it sound like sort of haphazardly gathered together after the fact. This is what I'm setting out to do. You might as well call a novel a collection of chapters, you know? It's a book.
Ben Lurie's collection, which we're not going to call a collection, is Stories for Nighttime and Some for the Day. It's published by Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.